I'm John Zipper. I'm your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. Now, 5 years ago, we launched Week to Week. It was an effort to have ongoing civil discussions of important political issues of the day. They said it would not succeed. They said we'd never find conservatives who would sit on a panel with liberals in ultra-liberal San Francisco. They said no one is interested in coming to a program on politics. Well, hashtag nevertheless, we persisted. This is our fifth anniversary Week to Week program, and we're very glad you're joining us here tonight in San Francisco. Now, on today's program, we are going to discuss the situation with the Oroville Dam, the loud town halls that have been rocking the GOP, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision last week on the president's travel ban, and, of course, other political news. And we'll end the evening with our week-to-week news quiz. As always, I note that the Commonwealth Club has people from a wide variety of viewpoints, so any opinions that are expressed up here are those purely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club itself. Now let's meet our panelists for today. I'll start on the other end there with Daniel Borenstein. He's a columnist and editorial writer for the East Bay Times. He's on Twitter at Borenstein Dan. And next to me is Bob Butler, a reporter for KCBS Radio. You can follow him on Twitter at BobButler7. So there are question cards throughout the room. Please use them to write down and send forward any questions you have. I will try to ask as many as possible during the program. Now on to our roundtable. Nearly 200,000 people have been evacuated from the area around the Oroville Dam in Northern California. As of today, the danger has reportedly started to decline, but they're not out of danger yet. More rain is coming later this week, and questions are being asked about when officials knew there was a problem with the dam and what didn't they do about it. So, Dan, let's start with you. What do you make of this Oroville Dam decision?
This was a colossal screw-up, it seems like. I mean, they, first of all, 10 years ago, Enviros were saying, hey, guys, you really ought to concrete line the emergency spillway. And the State Department of Water Resources and, of course, you know, Southern California water interests, we don't want to spend the money. And now, then they suddenly realized yesterday, holy cow, without a concrete lining, this thing is eroded back. They started using it for the first time and eroded back under, and it was exactly what they had warned could happen. You know, so you're clear what's going on here. There's the main spillway, which, as you probably know, last week was damaged when they were releasing water through it. So they slowed down there. The water starts building up in the dam. And then there's an emergency spillway, which is basically just the water top, so it comes over the top, right? And it has concrete up at the top, and it's the underpinnings are dirt. It sits on dirt. And the fear was that when water would come down, it would come back under, erode the dirt under the concrete, and you could lose the entire top of the thing, and it would all come down. So what have we had happening in the last week or so? Oh, they've been saying over and over, no worries, no worries, everything's fine, everything's fine. And then suddenly on 1 hour's notice yesterday, holy cow, this could happen. And the scenario they were fearing, the dirt was starting to erode away under the concrete. And this is exactly the scenario that's been warned about. I mean, wow, this is state and federal authorities totally screwing up.
So, Bob, an act of God or government mismanagement?
It's both. I mean, when you have that much rain as we've had in the last month or so, mm-hmm. I mean, the dam is as high as it's been as far as I can remember. When you have to release as much water as they're releasing now, you don't have that. We haven't had it, you know, for the last 6-7 years, we haven't had this much rain. So the problem is you have that much rain, and then you have the problem that you mentioned where they had a hole in the spillway where the water was going through and it started to wipe away all the dirt. That is the problem when you have, you know, I'm not going to call it government malfeasance, although 12 years ago, environmentalists went to the state and the feds and said, we need to concrete the spillway. And as you said, it'll be okay. Well, it's not okay, and I think the problem is it's going to cost a lot more now to fix it than what it would have cost back then.
Someone asks from the audience, is this the same structural failure as the Johnstown flood?
I have no idea. I don't know.
I don't know. Johnstown, Pennsylvania?
Yes. Well,
I think that was before my time.
Sorry, can't answer that one. So you mentioned federal and state, you know, agencies and groups. Is this something that's going to be a real, not to turn a very serious human problem and ecological problem into pure politics, but is this a political danger for the governor or?
Well, it should have some political fallout in a certain sense, because some of the same players at DW who were involved at DWR 12 mm-hmm. years ago are some of the players who are now involved with the governor's Twin Tunnels plan. And you know, you got to start wondering, really, can't we just get right what we have first? Do we really want to do these grandiose things when we can't seem to execute right what we got? Remember, this is like what the country's tallest dam.
Yeah.
I think we want to get this right. And I'm not sure we really want to start digging under the Delta, which, by the way, is going to really take a hit in all of this, too, because of all the water that's going to come flowing down. I'm sure we're going to have levee failures.
Bob, what do you think the state's appetite is for all the infrastructure spending that would be needed to get up to date in all of these?
Pardon me, I'm fighting off this bug that's been going around. The state's going to have to spend some money. Yeah, excuse me. It's going to have to spend some money to fix this. You know, the governor's already asked the federal government for emergency funds. The president has not acted on it yet. I did see a story today warning fake news that the president declined to answer California's request because of sanctuary cities. He said no. I've only seen that one place. I've looked everywhere. I even emailed the guy that wrote the story and didn't get a response back. So beware of fake news. But the president has not responded yet. They want money not just for this dam, but for all the other damage caused by the rains over the last month or so. So that is going to be an issue, because if I'm the president, I'm saying, well, wait, California, you guys were approached about this 12 years ago. You didn't fix it then. Now you want us to help you out? And I would say, well, the Army Corps of Engineers is always involved in these things, so yeah, we need your help.
Yeah, I think it's important to keep in mind, though, that the agency that had the ultimate decision on whether or not to put in the concrete liner on the emergency spillway was FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is a federal agency. They were the ones who had the ultimate decision-making.
And when was that?
That was about 2006, if I recall correctly.
It was 12 years. 2005, I think, is when they went to recertify the dam.
Yeah.
And the environmentalists asked for them to concrete spillway, and they said no.
So this could negatively affect George W. Bush's reelection, is what you're saying.
No. It was because of Obama.
So Governor Brown has declared a state of emergency there, right?
I'm not sure of a total state of emergency, but he asked for emergency relief from the federal government.
Okay. I think I read there are about 100 state troopers in the area. The National Guard has been put on notice that they might be called in.
John, I think it's really important to keep in mind, though, this crisis, if you will, is not over.
Yeah.
And as we're speaking now, they are not letting people back in. And there's real good reason for that. And that is that we are sitting here, there's sort of a rush to draw down the water level because they know we've got another big storm coming. And the math is kind of crazy as to whether they're going to make it in time. So this is not over, not by a long shot.
Yeah, they're expecting 6 inches of rain, maybe
6 to 8 inches of rain
Thursday and Friday, and you know that's 6 to 8 inches of rain. You know it doesn't just lift the reservoir 6 to 8 inches; all the water that flows into it, so it goes up a lot more than that. So that could be a serious problem. And boy, we better not get one of those warm storms coming through that starts to melt the snowpack. Then we'll really have a problem. That'll be like 97, the New Year's storm. Whether it flooded Yosemite, it flooded Merced, it flooded, you know, Manteca, and I was out there covering those floods, walking around in floodwater trying to talk to people whose homes were flooded. It caused the mudslides down in Guerneville. Remember those too. So that's if we have a warm storm, it's going to be a real problem. Right now, it's not supposed to be that warm up in the mountains, but any rain we get is going to be a problem. Look what happened up in Marin just this past week.
Someone asks, is Oroville in a red or blue county? Does anyone know?
It's Butte, isn't it?
It's Butte County. Yeah, it's
the wetter it gets, it'll be bluer.
If I remember the map, it's probably a red county.
Yeah.
Let's move on to our next topic. And I think we all remember the scenes from, what was it, about 8 years ago, when angry constituents showed up at town hall meetings that U.S. Congress people were having back in their districts, shouting about, you know, healthcare reform efforts that were going on at the time. Democrats really felt the hurt at that time, and they paid dearly in the midterm elections, losing control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, this winter, it's Republicans who are having overflow crowds of angry constituents and at their town halls. And once again, healthcare is the main issue that they're, not the only, but it's the main issue that is bringing people out. So, Bob, is this a replay of what we've already seen? Does this mean healthcare, for example, is the proverbial third rail that you shouldn't touch?
I think it is, and it's so ironic that the people were so upset about, you know, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, and it was going to have death panels, and it's going to take away your insurance and everything else. And, you know, don't touch my health care. Keep your hands off my health care. These are folks on Medicare, you know. No government health care. And I went to some of those meetings. I met one with Pete Stark out of Fremont. Man, it was crazy. You know, you had people yelling and screaming, and he couldn't barely talk, and that's what it's like now. Mm-hmm. And the irony is, you know, they're trying to say these are Democrats going to the Republican town halls raising hell, but it's not just Democrats. These are people who are Republicans who are the same people saying, keep your hands off my health care, that now have Obamacare or the ACA, and they want to keep it because it actually has saved lives. So that's the irony of this whole thing.
Dan, so there's a group calling itself Indivisible, and it's made up of former Democratic congressional staffers, as I understand it. And Indivisible has been a key rallying force behind these moves and number of protests across the country. Dan, are we seeing the left's version of a Tea Party?
Well, that'll be the question we'll have to see, is whether the left can mobilize as effectively, frankly, as the Tea Party did. It's a real test of the ability of the left to not fracture the way, and to stay coalesced the way the Tea Party has. Of course, the left has this tendency to not be able to control its ultra-left fringe. It's the ultra-left anarchist, violence, which is really, you know, has the danger of tainting the whole movement, which is unfortunate, as we saw at Berkeley.
Yeah, I don't look at the anarchists as being Democrats or Republicans, left or right. These are just people that want to come out and break stuff.
Yeah, but they tend to want to come out and break stuff at demonstrations that are left-leaning demonstrations, and that's where it becomes problematic. I agree with you. Mm-hmm. You know, but the problem is that they don't come out. You know, they come out for demonstrations from the left. They don't come out for demonstrations from the right.
Well, especially here, because the numbers are so great. My first experience with them, it's called Black Bloc. These are the people that you see dressed up all in black with the hoods and the watch caps and the face masks. They don't want people to see their faces. And I remember seeing them actually at a demonstration before the first Gulf War, where they lined up near City Hall, and they actually lined up in formation. And they started marching with people, and then when they got down to Union Square, they broke off and began running through Macy's, breaking, you know, display cases and windows, and that's their tactic. And they started doing that a long time ago. So the tragedy, the reason they do it with the left-leaning demonstrations is in California, when you have a conservative demonstration, there aren't that many people there, you know? So I'm not saying that to be funny, but that's the truth. So you couldn't get away with it there. Plus, you know, you go to some of these places where you get a lot of the, you know, the good old boys out there, and they got the shotguns in the truck, so that they don't want to deal with that. But it is a shame that a lot of the demonstrations that we do see that are very peaceful get the bad name because of these anarchists and these idiots who, you know, I've been attacked by these people before, and it's not physically, but it's just a guy painted the anarchist symbol on my back with spray paint while I was on the air live. It's like, I didn't know what he was doing until after I was off the air, but it gets pretty crazy.
Wow.
But this is what happens, you know. This is the ammunition then that ends, you know, that gives the ammunition the Donald Trumps of the world, mm-hmm. that, you know, the left, and, you know, you see Berkeley is no longer allowing free speech. Well, I mean, they were doing everything they could to allow it but not let people get hurt. And, you know, they were caught between a rock and a hard place in how to manage this.
David Frum, the conservative former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, wrote on The Atlantic, I don't know if it was in the magazine, but I saw it on the website, he was giving advice to the left on their anti-Trump protests of various sorts. And he was saying a number of things. One was, have a big tent. You know, don't worry about if this group here maybe disagrees with you on one or two issues, it doesn't matter. What's your overall point? And make, you know, that your big thing, and let everyone who agrees with you in. But another one he said was, make, you know, wrap yourself in the flag. You know, I mean, actually think about what Hillary Clinton did in her Democratic National Convention. I mean, there were Republicans who, you know, like from National Review and other elsewhere, who were saying, I thought I was watching a Republican convention. They were saying it admiringly. You know, she said, look, these values are American values. And David Frum was saying, do that, because otherwise you're going to get that pushback of, you people are destroying, you know.
Well, this is at the core and in the heart of, you know, all the post-election debate about where the Democrats go from here. And they really do have a challenge of they can carry California. The question is, can they carry states in the Rust Belt? Can they carry the swing states? And they can't carry the swing states if they're just a hardcore, hardline left movement. They won't do that. You know, they have to be a bigger tent to succeed.
Someone in the audience asks, besides breaking stuff, do the anarchists have an objective?
To break stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been out there, I've watched them, I've talked to a few of them, and, you know, Whatever the issue is, I mean, I was out there for one when Johannes Messerli was convicted in Southern California for the Oscar Grant shooting. There was a big demonstration in Oakland, and I was there. And, you know, they broke into the Foot Locker. And I'm talking to this one person, and I said, what's this about? Well, the verdict wasn't strong enough. I said, but what does shoes have to do with it? It's nonsensical. I was at another demonstration, and a lot of these people that you see who are dressed like that, they're suburban kids. You know, they're not from the inner city. You can tell by looking at them. You know, but even some of those people who are from the inner city, they get in on it too because they get sucked in. Mm-hmm. But shoes? And I said, why shoes? People are hungry out here. It must have been Mother Hubbard. You know, I just don't know. But I've talked to other kids, you know, young people that have come out for one of these demonstrations, and I'm here because, you know, we need to take a stand. So why are you breaking into Metro PCS? I want to get a phone. I want to get some headsets. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
That's really why they're out there.
Well, let's move on. You all saw the news, I'm sure. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals last Thursday issued its ruling on the Trump administration's effort to reinstate its ban on travel into the U.S. for people from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. Now, the Trump administration kind of was going back and forth over the weekend whether or not they would appeal. I'm kind of wondering what you thought of. Well, first, let's just start with the decision. Bob, I mean, what did you think of it? Was this unexpected? Was this...
The Ninth Circuit's decision?
Yeah.
I think the 3-0 was unexpected. Yeah. I think there were, even listening to some of the coverage that we did, the thinking was it would have been 2-1 to stop, to issue an injunction. When it came back 3-0, that was a real slap in the face to the administration. You know, the latest is, you know, we were told last week that they were going to do something today. And what they did today, when I say they, the administration, they actually asked the judge in Washington to put off any more hearings on this issue while the Ninth Circuit decides if it's going to go en banc or not. And the judge came back later today and said, no, we're going to keep on moving. So the administration wants to wants to put a halt to any proceedings, and the judge is saying, no, we're going to keep going.
Well, you know, it's important sort of to keep in mind what was at stake here. The issue, you know, the issue was whether to block the stay, if you will, out of Washington State. And basically, the appellate court, in my mind, was understandably offended at the arguments that were put forth. Basically, the Trump administration's key argument was, you don't have the authority to review this. The judicial branch doesn't have the authority to do this. And, you know, whatever you may think of the merits of what he's proposing or not, what the court said very clearly was, you know, yeah, absolutely we have the authority. We live in a constitutional democracy, and the courts very definitely have the authority to review this. And I think on that point, it's not surprising that they unified, because this wasn't just an argument on the merits. This was an argument, the Trump administration's argument was basically an attack on the courts, if you will, and the role of the courts. Our editorial basically said, and, you know, I wrote it, so I agree with it, obviously, you know, that, you know, basically what the court did is they gave the president a lesson in constitutional democracy that he apparently was lacking until this point, you know. And, you know, I mean, it was pretty troubling, the argument they were making. I think on that point, it was a loser. On the rest of the merits, they basically said, no, we're not going to, we don't see the emergency that you see. You haven't proved the emergency. And so basically at this point, I think the Trump administration has to, you know, they've basically come to concede that they're going to have to go through the courts. So in that sense, it worked. You know, he actually maybe learned a lesson.
It was just stunning listening to the actual hearing in which the courts basically asked the solicitor or the attorney for the administration, so can you give us any evidence that anybody from these countries has harmed anybody in the United States? And he said, well, no. Okay. Is it your view that the president's executive order is unreviewable? And they said, yes. And the court's like, really? So the court came back and said, well, guess again. You know, just going to the original executive order to stop the immigration of people coming from these seven countries, on the surface, I can understand the president saying we have to stop this kind of immigration from people that are going to harm this country. But the fact that you didn't have on there countries that have already demonstrated that their citizens will kill Americans, that's, I think, a big problem with that whole executive order. Because there are countries, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, where the hijackers from 9/11 came from, they're not on that list. And I would hate to think it's because the president has business there. But that's the fact.
What do you think? They, being the Trump administration, went back and forth on whether or not they would appeal this. My reading of it is kind of they're leaning more toward trying a new executive order. Do you think that's because they looked at this and said, we don't think we can get five votes?
I don't think they can. First of all, I don't think on an 8-member Supreme Court that they can get that they can overturn the Ninth Circuit decision. I don't think that's likely. But I think the other part of it is that I think they can probably issue a new order much more quickly, frankly, than they can go up the line in the courts. I mean, he could have a new order out by tomorrow, which he's basically said he might do.
Right, right.
So whereas if he took the next step, we're going to have to brief it. We're going to go through the whole thing again. I don't see that.
And hopefully this does happen. You know, I was reading where members of the government, you know, the civil servants who do this stuff for a living were just appalled that nobody came to them and asked them how to do this. You know, how do you write this where it'll pass muster? They didn't do that. Hopefully they'll go back and do that this time if they do it again.
Okay. In the coverage I saw about this, especially leading up, while people were waiting for the decision to come down, and as you know, journalists are stuck writing stories to fill time because nothing has happened yet.
No.
They kept referring to, you know, the Ninth Circuit Court as a liberal court. But 3-0, does that kind of say that even on a liberal court, that's such a resounding decision?
Well, this wasn't just all Democratic presidential appointee judges, as I recall.
We
had a Bush appointee, you know. I mean...
I think it was one Clinton, one Obama, one Bush.
Yeah, but you know, I've seen various numbers on the Ninth Circuit, but the thinking is that the Ninth Circuit, whereas 10, 15 years ago, it was being constantly overturned, that it's become a more stabilized, you know, more in keeping with the national trends. Now, I don't study this, so
Now, immigration is or was one of the key points of Donald Trump's campaign, and they moved very quickly when they got into office to try to implement certain things. There's been quite a bit of reporting lately on the immigration raids that have taken place, and some people saying actually probably not related. Maybe they are. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, there are quite a few big, high-profile raids, at least, they're making.
Yeah, I mean, despite all of the rhetoric, the Obama administration deported more illegal immigrants than any other president. And, you know, this whole thing about being soft on illegal immigration is really kind of ludicrous because I believe I read today 2.5 million people between 2009 and 2015 were deported. And if you go back, you have to go back like 40 years to get that number of people deported by administrations, people who are here illegally. And they're targeting people. He was targeting people that had committed crimes, which I have a hard time accepting that if you come here illegally, that you have no consequences. Okay? But the problem is, as Dan mentioned earlier, we've now built our economy on illegal immigration. So what are we going to do if we kick all those people out? What's going to happen? I don't know.
Well, and I think there's another part of this, which coming back to the decision, it's important to distinguish between dealing with raids that may or may hopefully are only dealing with serious criminals, in which case fine, deport them, versus closing our borders to people who have nowhere to go. Who are from, you know, this notion that we're going to cut off any access of people from Syria. I mean, these people, this is shades of the 30s and 40s, you know, Nazi Germany, you know, refugees from Nazi Germany, and we closed our borders. Are we really going to do this again? I find that's a very different paradigm, or very different issue, but they all get melded together, and that's where it gets really sad and scary.
And it's been the execution. You know, this thing happens so quickly. If you look at the order comes out, and all of a sudden you're on a plane when the order comes out, and you land in the United States, and you're being told, "Oh, you can't come in because you visited Pakistan, or you visited Syria, or you visited, you know, I don't know, Lebanon." You know, and they've turned people away that actually were coming here to work.
Yeah.
You know, and because they had been to one of these countries on their passport, you know, they were told basically you can't come in. You know, I don't know if I come in and you tell me you're going to give me a ticket to go back home, business class, please. You know, sure, but it's very troubling, especially when you have Iraqi translators who put their lives on the line to help American troops who come here and they're being told they can't come in. Or they're being delayed. I mean, if you're delayed a little bit and you get in, okay. But people that are being sent back, that's just inhumane.
Potential death sentence.
Yeah.
Someone writes, an immigrant contractor today told me that a national one-day labor walkout is being planned for mid-March. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I've heard of that. Yeah, people saying they're going to walk off the job for just one day. If you're illegal, an illegal immigrant, an undocumented worker, and you walk off the job, I wonder whether the administration will send a bunch of CP Border Patrol agents. I mean, I wouldn't, at this point, you wouldn't put it past them because it's one very effective way of rounding people up. I don't know.
Someone else writes, if Trump writes a new executive order on this, does it go to the same courts or to the same judges, or how does it end up in one court or another? How does that, can you give us some sense? This was from Washington.
Right. Well, this current decision is out of Washington State, and all we've done now is, all this Ninth Circuit has done, remember, is sent the case, allowed the case to proceed in Washington State. We have not had a ruling on the merits of the order yet, even. All we've had is a ruling on the stay while the proceedings go forward. So exactly what the process would be if he writes a new order, whether, you know, the Washington State Court might, I guess, still claim jurisdiction if it's not tangibly different. And then I guess if not, then the question would be, who are the new plaintiffs and where do they file? Presumably. I mean, you know, I'm not a lawyer.
I mean, I guess he could withdraw the first one and submit another substitute.
Right, yeah. Well, that's clearly what he, if he goes that route, that's how clearly how he'll do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
California Governor Jerry Brown has quite the reputation as an eco-warrior. He also has a reputation as a fiscal skinflint. These are two topics I'm kind of melding together for a reason, because his reputation recently has been criticized on both fronts. Dan, I want to start with you, because on the latter part, about financial control and planning, you recently took the governor to task in the East Bay Times. Tell us about what that was about and why you did it.
I'm sure most of you remember back in 2012, the governor was ballyhooing his so-called pension reform that was supposed to control pension costs and make a major substantial difference in the cost of pensions and control some of the spiking that was going on. It was supposed to be reform. And at the time, I wrote that it was basically fiddling on the margins, and it really was not. It was mainly just a tweak. It really wasn't substantial reform. And the numbers are bearing it out. Here we are 5 years later, and actually, pension costs for state government are up 36% from 2012. And actually, the unfunded liabilities, the shortfalls in the pension systems, are up as well. If you look at state and local government, we now face somewhere in the neighborhood of about $375 billion in unfunded liabilities if you use the current questionable accounting methods. If you use more reasonable accounting methods, it's substantially more. So, you know, the governor stayed silent on my column, interestingly enough, but CalPERS tried to come to his defense and say this was major reform, it made a big difference. And they cited one statistic, and I said, well, okay, if you know, in terms of how it's trimmed some government costs a couple cents on the dollar of payroll. And I said, okay, but let's look at all the other costs. Would you send me all the figures on the other costs that go with that have gone up at the same time so that we can look at the whole picture? And I'm still waiting for the
crickets,
numbers.
Huh?
I mean, basically what he did is, you know, and maybe this is not the day to use this analogy, but the water's spilling, coming over the dam, and he's sticking a finger in a hole in the dike. You know, I mean, it was fiddling. It was not substantial pension reform. And our problem today with public employee pensions is worse than it was when his so-called reform was passed. And by the way, when he first proposed it in 2012, as you might recall, it all came down in 3 days. I don't know if anybody remembers this. I remember it vividly because on day two, as I got time to read the bill as it was being proposed and going through it, I noticed that it would actually allow more pension spiking than was going on at the time. And I did a column day before the vote that went up online the day before the vote and appeared in print the day morning of the vote, which is the last day of the legislative session. And there was a trailer bill that was instantly created because when the, I don't think the administration fully appreciated what was in their own bill. Yeah, I mean, they were arguing with me. No, it wasn't. It wouldn't do this. It wouldn't do this. Suffice to say, there was a bill that passed that was passed at the same time to fix the problem I raised on that. It was just, it was a gut and amend of another bill on that day. Well, that is the, one of the bills now that is the subject of litigation that the court rulings thus far have suggested could open the way to actually making some changes in the pension system that could actually make them affordable for taxpayers and make the accounting a little bit better. So there's sort of this unintended consequence that came about that only came about because he was forced to, frankly, that may actually make a difference sometime where down the line.
Well, is it the kind of thing where it's politically unpalatable to do, especially if you're a candidate who relies on public union support, not exclusively, but that's one of your bases, that the only way, therefore, you could get change that you'd like to see is through the courts?
Well, yeah, I mean, look at, first of all, in terms of the politics of this, the governor has to decide. And he has the political capital at this point that he could decide that he's going to do the right thing, not just the politically popular thing. And the right thing is not to do away with public employee pension systems, as some have suggested on the right. The right thing is to fix it so it's affordable and that the unfunded liabilities don't continue to grow and grow and grow. So he does have that option. That said, if it ends up in the courts, understand that all the courts will probably do, if they should come down in terms of making some change, mm-hmm. is they would open the way for the legislature, if it chose to fix the system, or an initiative could do that. The chances of the legislature changing this, yeah. So, you know, I mean, even the court's rule allowing some reform, there's a long road ahead. And the only thing that would kick it down the road in an expeditious way would be if the governor really put some political capital behind it, which he has not done to date.
What do you think? Is Brown leaving behind a ticking financial time bomb for whoever takes office after him?
Well, I'll just tell you one story about when it comes to pensions. I got a friend, high school classmate. He was a cop. He retired, I think, at age 50. And I was talking to him. He's now working as a head of security for a golf course somewhere. So he now gets to draw, you know, I don't know how much, but probably $80,000, $90,000 a year is his pension. And he said, you know, I didn't expect to make that much money, but they said this is what I had to take. And it's not like people don't want to get paid that much money, but I mean, that's a pretty nice pension. And now he's also getting paid by this other job. And he says, you know, they said I had to take this much money. You know, it was like it was forced on him. He's not going to give it back.
The poor dear.
But I have coffee every Friday at Starbucks and most of the guys that are there are retired CHP. And these are all guys who went on a medical disability or whatever, and they're all retired. You know, and these are guys who are younger than me. And they're all, I mean, I know law enforcement is a very tough job. You know, and it's a very dangerous job. One of our guys actually was on the job like 2 years and took a medical disability, a medical retirement, because he was shot by his partner during a robbery. You know, this is by accident, but they went to a call of a robbery in progress. The bad guy comes out the back door. He gets shot in the leg. He falls down. His partner can't see who he is, you know, because he wasn't wearing his yellow rain slicker. He shot a couple of times. The guy got shot by his partner. You know, he's on medical disability now for the rest of his life. You know, I don't know what the answer is, but I mean, it's a lot of money when you think of one person who's retiring at age 50 and now you're going to live another 40 years making that kind of money. That's where that really adds up.
I know what the answer is, but I won't go into it now. It's way too complicated.
Yeah. Well, then an easier answer, or a shorter one, perhaps. Do you think Maybe you answered this already. Do you think Brown will even attempt to do anything else on this in his remaining time in office?
That's a good question.
He's just moved on.
That's a real good question. And that's if he chose to, he could make some difference. Otherwise, frankly, all of his rainy day fund measures and all of his other areas where he's trying to rein in costs, the money he saved there will pale in comparison to the ballooning retirement costs that he's left behind.
Very good. Now, we were talking earlier about some of the less savory aspects of some of these protests. And, of course, at the heart of most of these protests have been, you know, men and women going out there and wearing knitted caps and really making their voices heard. Another place that people who are making their voices heard, who oppose Donald Trump and his policies, have been on, you know, the state and local governmental level. Some of them, of course, are now kind of worrying about Donald Trump's threats to reduce funding to certain cities and states, sanctuary cities in particular. I don't know if you saw this story. There was a word that some BART directors are proposing making the BART system a sanctuary system. Bob, that's not going to help them get state or federal transportation money, is it?
No. In fact, I can kind of see where if you're a city, you say you're not going to cooperate, you know, for some guy that gets busted for, you know, a taillight on his car or a speeding ticket or something like that. But how do you do it on a transit system? Okay, if I find somebody coming out of the MacArthur station who's undocumented now, are they going to call, you know, ICE at that point? No. I mean, I don't see where there's a need for it.
Well, their argument is, and I find myself in this really unusual position of explaining BART's position, you know, but BART's argument is that they have a police department, they do arrest people, and, you know, if they find that there's something in their history or they're undocumented, should they turn them over to ICE? Of course, the kicker of that story, as I pointed out, if you get to the last line of it, after we go through all this back and forth about the politics, which make these great headlines, and it tells you a lot about the BART board, I will tell you that. The question is posed to their spokeswoman as to exactly how many people they've referred to ICE in the last 6 years. Yeah, none.
For those of you listening, yes, he said zero.
Zero, yeah.
Zero, yeah. For those of you listening, sorry, that was a goose egg. it feels good in the Bay Area, I guess. You know, but it has. This is sometimes I wonder, are these really the battles worth picking?
Well, and BART receives nearly $100 million a year in federal funding. So, you know, will Bay Area commuters be happy to pick up that extra tab? Do you want to? You know,
I suspect it's actually potentially more than that too.
Yeah. Okay.
I just Bob? Like I said, I don't see the point. I mean, that's politics. You know, a lot of times, like you said, you do something because it makes you feel good. Right. You know. A city council passing a resolution opposing some policy that's passed in Washington doesn't do any good. It's not going to make any difference, but they do it anyway.
We would not have any federal funding from Washington if we just left the union. It's called CalExit. KQED and other sources have reported, quote, on paper, the leader of the California secession movement lives in an apartment complex near San Diego's Golden Hill neighborhood. But in reality, the CalExit campaign is being run by a 30-year-old who lives and works in a city on the edge of Siberia.
Literally.
Yes. Are we just, do we have another political pawn that's been created by Russia that, you know, people then are kind of running around and getting excited about? And it was intended to be nothing more than, sorry, did I have to do that? It was intended to be nothing more than a red herring for people to get excited about. What do you think?
Well, he actually, if you read what he says he actually started this movement before he moved to Russia. His wife is from Russia, and he started it when he was here. And, you know, you've heard about this for years, about secession, about Southern California breaking off from Northern California. These things happen every couple of years. But in this case, you know, it seems as if he's getting encouraged to do this by some people in the Kremlin. Now, I wasn't there. I don't know. All I know is what I read. But if that's the case, I mean, come on, dude. You know, wake up.
Yeah, the story did say, the story that this idea has been covered very heavily by the official Soviet news agencies and the communist agencies over there.
And eventually after the election, unfortunately, mainstream media bit on it. And, you know, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, if it reaches a critical mass, you got to cover it. But at this point, I think it was one of those stories that had sort of a ooh appeal. But, you know, and I guess it got pushed along by a poll. Was it a PPIC poll or a field poll? Something like in the 30, something like 30 some odd percent of people would favor this. And I'm thinking, who are these people? You know, I mean, it's,
And you can't really secede from the Union, can you? I mean,
from the Soviet Union?
That worked.
Well, I mean, I think we had a civil war over this issue 150 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
you know, it's how would that work? Okay, so we're going to now become our own country. You know, we do have a really good, we're like the sixth largest economy in the world. I wonder if it would stay that way if we all of a sudden seceded from the Union. And, you know, now you have to get a passport to go to Reno to gamble. If nothing else, I think the gambling industry would oppose that.
Yep. Okay, well then, as someone in the audience said, then why are we talking about it? So let's move on. And someone else in the audience raised a question that is actually the next topic we're going to go
well,
into.
But why we're go talking ahead, about it is not because of the concept, but at this point, what makes this story interesting and newsworthy is sort of that it's being driven, it's the story behind the story that's being driven by Russian influence, which is of note and is worth, especially because this idea is out there. Mm-hmm. It is important, I think, now that people understand some of the influence that's driving it. The discussion of it is not so much about the concept, it's about what's driving it.
How much influence Russia is going to try to have on this country.
Yeah.
You know, we've heard about what's happening in Washington, you know, with the National Security Advisor. I mean, that's a big story. And, you know, I almost feel bad for the guy. I mean, why would you do that? Why would you call and talk to...
This is General Mike Flynn.
Yeah, he's now the National Security Advisor, who was actually in contact with the Russian ambassador before the election. And then after the election, the implication is that he had conversations about the sanctions that Obama put on the Russians because of the election hacking. At first he said, no, well, I never didn't talk about that. And now he's come back and said, well, I'm not really sure if it came up. So he's backtracked. And that's a big deal because that's against the law to do stuff like that.
When California secedes, we can put our own sanctions on Russia and just start it all over again.
With our own military.
Yeah.
Okay. Kind of going back to President Trump's immigration executive order, there's also been talk of the Trump administration addressing H-1B visas. These are the visas that companies will use to bring in educated workers from other countries to take positions here. And now in Silicon Valley, this is a very, very highly used mechanism. High tech, biotech around here, heavily staffed, and oftentimes the heads of the companies are from other countries. So I wanted to talk a bit about what you thought Silicon Valley, have they identified this as an issue that has energized them and maybe made them more politically outspoken lately, because they seem to have kind of, you know, Google and Apple and some of the others seem to have stepped up their public statements on the immigration issue since they kind of.
Well, I think it's an issue that's near and dear to the Valley, but more importantly, I think what's also driving these leaders is the sort of secondary part of that, which is that their employees, many of them are immigrants, and at a certain point, they've got to have some respect for their own workforce that's so critical to their survival. And if you become, as the CEO of Uber quickly found out, if you get tagged as anti-immigrant, that is not good for your company. If you're dependent on immigrants,
right?
Legal immigrants
yeah. as a key part of your company.
Should explain that a little bit. The CEO of Uber, based here in San Francisco, was on Donald Trump's advisory committee, one of his advisory committees of business or tech leaders. I don't know if it was one or all. And Uber found itself the target of both a widespread boycott movement. There were protests outside the Uber offices on Market Street. He has left the advisory board, but I don't know if they've stopped the bleeding at the company.
Yeah, because people started deleting the Uber app off their phones.
Yeah.
They quit using Uber. And Lyft got a nice little bump in business.
Lyft got a lift, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder, okay, this might have energized Silicon Valley companies, but... a lot of those Trump voters who have watched their jobs go away, and I would suspect there's a connection there between Trump and those voters saying, look, these people are giving your jobs, or jobs you could have, to foreigners.
Sure, that was the core of his campaign.
Right. Yeah,
that was the core argument of his campaign. And keep in mind, where are most of these tech companies? They're in the state that, frankly, we know is blue and isn't going to make a difference in a presidential election because that it's not a swing state. So absolutely, you're absolutely right that the question is how this plays in Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin, as we found out. That's the question, yeah.
But the issue, though, is these H-1, these visas are used to bring in people that have the qualifications and skills these companies are looking for, okay? And we've heard about Americans not being smart enough to do these jobs. Now, I don't totally agree with that, but if I'm an employer and I get these three kids in India who, are hackers and they know all about coding and everything and I can bring them in here and pay them a lower wage, why not do that? Now, I'm not saying that's what they're doing, but, I mean... But I also think one of the reasons why these companies are speaking up, the people that started these high-tech companies, their social awareness is very high when it comes to look at some of these companies and how they work. These are the ones that started the open floor plans where you have beanbag chairs and ping pong tables. This is all for the millennial generation that wants to come to work and have fun. Well, they're catering to that, and these people understand that, so I can understand how they would not want to jeopardize them being able to get the people they need to do this kind of work. Plus, when you think about the fact that this ban is essentially on Muslims, and a lot of the people that are coming over here are Muslim, I can see why they would speak out.
I have one more topic I want to quickly get into before we run through some more questions from the audience, and that is we've seen over the past week or so a number of tweets from the president, comments from Kellyanne Conway, among others, telling people to buy Trump products, we're angry at Nordstrom and such. Any thoughts on where there's a lot of commentary these days that this is a conflict of interest bonanza, if you will. Do you think this is something that, kind of like with executive actions, they'll learn as they're getting in, they'll funnel down and be more of a traditional administration, or do you think we're headed toward, some major
impeachment? Well, it's interesting the split, right? Because Conway is in the administration, but she is subject to the conflict of interest laws. The president, on the other hand, is not, right? So he can say, my poor daughter, you should go buy her clothes. But if Conway says that, it's a conflict.
Yeah.
And so they're learning the line, but it's an egregious abuse of the power of the White House. It's troubling. This is not, when we start using it, are we going to start selling branding rights to the White House?
I don't know.
The new Trump Tower.
I listened to the interview, and it was not like, this was a whole segment on going to buy Ivanka's stuff. It was kind of a throwaway line. Oh, I like her stuff. I think it's great. You ought to go buy it. But that's a conflict. It is. It's wrong. It's against the law to do that, okay? Mm-hmm. Whether there'll be any consequences, we don't know. But I do think I'm more concerned about all of the other conflicts of interest that have not been addressed.
Such as
hosting the president or the prime minister of Japan at your golf course. You basically are giving free room and board to the president of the prime minister of Japan and possibly also his entourage. Although I've heard his entourage stayed at the Marriott or something like that. But I don't believe that. I mean, the whole thing about the properties he has, when people come to stay at his properties and foreign dignitaries come and stay at Trump Tower because they want to ingratiate themselves with the president, that's why you're not supposed to do that. So I think I'm more concerned about those kinds of issues. I'm more concerned about, his son's going on business trips and costing the taxpayers $100,000 for Secret Service protection. And that's going to continue happening, forever, for as long as he's president.
Okay, let's run through some questions before we get to the news quiz. President Trump, this is a good question for two newsmen. President Trump continues to dominate the news as in the campaign. Your thoughts, can the media be encouraged to focus more on some other politicians? So first of all, shame on you.
Look, he is the president of the United States. I don't know how we can not focus on him. We are witnessing, for better or worse, something we've never seen before. How can we not cover it? Of course we're going to cover it. This is not going to change overnight. It's not all flattering news about him, not by a long shot. As a matter of fact, his poll ratings are not exactly very good. But I do think it's important that we do focus on what's going on. This is an important moment in our country's history. And, shame on us if we aren't blanketing it very carefully, every aspect of it. If anything, I don't think we can do enough of it. It's the question of it being quality, good journalism. And frankly, I think I think some of the national reporting has been just pretty excellent.
Yeah, finally. Yeah. Because for a long time, he was getting almost as much coverage, and it was all, I don't want to say favorable, but it was like, oh, look what Trump said today. And he would always say something outrageous. He would always be in the news. And carrying his rallies live, from wall to wall. I mean, people pay lots of money to get that kind of coverage. He paid nothing. So he was basically given a lot of free advertising during the campaign that led to him being elected. Because I don't think without all that free coverage, he would have been elected. But now that he's the president, you can't not cover him. What I think is encouraging is that now the coverage is a lot more critical. I believe had it been this critical from the beginning, again, I'm not sure he would have been elected. But he's there, so you have to cover him. Now, I find it really ironic now that, when you have Trump spokespeople on the air and they are saying something that is demonstrably not true, You see a super go up saying that's not true. That's just, in journalism, we've never done that before, but you are forced to do it because of what comes out. I mean, yesterday on the Sunday morning news shows, you had this, one of the Trump, his chief of staff or chief of something.
Chief of policy.
Chief of policy, get up there and talk about all the people that voted illegally in New Hampshire, and they have proof of this. And when he was asked to show the proof, he said, well, I'm not going to take the time to show you the proof now, but trust me, it's there. We have it. The president said so, and I can tell you I will go on anytime, anywhere, and tell you that this is happening. But there's no proof. And today they had the head of the former head of the Republican Party in New Hampshire go on the air and call the guy a liar. So that's never happened. So you have to do that kind of coverage of him, and it's not going to stop because I don't see the administration changing the way it treats the media, which, you know, if you're somebody who wants to get free coverage, they're getting free coverage. Now they're going to get it because he's president. But, you know, would I like to cover him less? Yeah, but you can't because he's the president.
Very good. Well, thank you, panel. Now we've got some questions for you. This is time for our news quiz. If Colette could come forward, she's going to be our prize delivery person. If you've never been here before, I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll point to you and you can shout it out. And if you get it correct, Colette will give you a little bag of chocolate. So the first question. Trump White House. Okay. First question. North Korea sent a message to Japan this week. What did it do? Way in back there, sir.
Test launched a ballistic missile.
That's right. It sent a ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan. Next question. Does anyone know the name of the new president of Germany? Was that a hand? No one? Anyone want to guess? Just kind of say it with a German accent. It might. Okay. It's Frank-Walter Steinmeier. He's the former foreign minister. Actually spoke at the Commonwealth Club at one point. Next question. Let's stay with Germany. The U.S. Tennis Association apologized to German players last week. Why did they do that? Ma'am, I saw your hand first. Go ahead. In the hat.
Me?
Yes.
They played the Nazi song.
Right. They played the part of the German anthem that was used during the Nazi years. Kind of a no-no. Next question. Betsy DeVos's education department was panned yesterday when it tweeted a quote about the importance of education from the late W.E.B. Du Bois. What did they get wrong? In the yellow there.
It's like, they
misspelled his name, and they misspelled something then when they apologized about it. So, is our children learning? A newspaper in the Dominican Republic thought it was printing a photo of President Trump. What did they actually print? Along the edge there.
The Saturday Night Live.
That's right. They printed Alec Baldwin doing his imitation of him. This weekend, San Francisco held its annual parade celebrating the Lunar New Year. What animal represents this year? Ma'am, your hand shot right up. The rooster, that's correct. See, you're the rooster. Sears and Kmart became the latest stores to do what? In back there, ma'am? They dropped Donald Trump home products, that's right. He was not happy. I'm sure he'll tweet about that. Due to his support for slavery, Yale University is going to rename a building that's currently named for who? Yeah. Way in back there?
No.
That's right, John C. Calhoun. Sorry. where are we? Seven. Let's go with. Why were 72,000 people evacuated from their homes in Greece this weekend? Ma'am.
They discovered an unexploded World War II bomb.
That's right, they discovered an unexploded World War II bomb. Despite a partial government backdown, protests are continuing in Romania over what controversial law? Someone who hasn't, in the red back there.
Essentially, the legalization of corruption.
That's right. It took a bunch of things under a certain level and said, it's legal. It legalized vast swaths of corrupt activities, bribery of government officials up to a certain level, stuff like that. This, by the way, in Romania, which already ranks as one of the most corrupt states in Europe. So one last question. Hollywood legend Mel Brooks was the surprise honoree at what big awards event yesterday?
Grammys.
Ma'am?
Grammys?
Nope. Sir, right behind her? No. Anyone? Oh, the BAFTAs, the British Academy Awards, so they're called. Let's do one more then. We got to give away that chocolate. Why did the U.S. government stop selling the official 2017 presidential inauguration poster? Sir. It misspelled something. There's a bit of a theme here in misspelling. Well, listen, we're going to have more news quiz questions and, of course, a lot more to talk about on May 13th right here in Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And you can find our week-to-week news quiz on the Huffington Post every Friday. Thank you to our great panel today. March 13th, yeah. Bob Butler and Dan Bornstein. And thanks to all of you here in our audience, everyone listening and watching online. Have a great week.